8 months later. C plus 49. Ford residence, Birchwood, Colorado. An alarm sounded on Dan's phone, telling him that it was time to go. 30 minutes until the comet is as close as it's ever going to get, he called to Emma, disabling the notification on his Diavolo tracker app. We need to get going. I'm glad it's nighttime, Tara said, standing up from the couch beside him and stretching her legs. Better view. In the 8 months since contact day, Tara Ford's life had finally begun moving in directions she was happy with. A career change from the world of modeling into the world of fashion design was the headline difference, and she couldn't have been more pleased with how it was going so far. Her initial involvement had been restricted to the licensing of her name and image, extremely lucratively, and without too great a cost in terms of her daily privacy and low-key lifestyle. But her ultimate intention was to become more and more hands-on in the design stages as time passed. Happily, the excellent initial sales of her first line made it very likely that she would be able to call a lot more shots when it came time to renegotiate the licensing terms. She had also moved into a contemporary apartment in Colorado Springs, close enough to still spend a lot of her free time in Birchwood, but far enough away to satisfy her independent nature. For Dan, the welcome trajectory of his own life could be best expressed by his main graph on Emma's social media meta-analysis app, where his key metrics now followed less of a roller coaster-like pattern and more of a constant and gradual downward return to something approaching normality. His level of celebrity continued to far exceed anything he had known prior to contact day, of course, but the madness of the first few post-contact months had steadily subsided. Being revered as a prophet and messiah was less fun for Dan than it might have sounded to many, but he was able to grin and bear the obsessive attention he still received from some quarters, largely because he had come to accept it as the inevitable price of doing what had to be done. This kind of fame had been the last thing Dan McCarthy had ever wanted, as everyone around him knew. But he would have done everything the same way 100 times over if that was what it took to get the truth out and safeguard humanity's very future. He likewise quietly endured the monthly medical checkups he and Emma were required to undergo at approved federal facilities, none of which had detected anything unusual in their necks or anywhere else. Emma had been questioned extensively by Harris and his colleagues following her release from the hospital, but no one was overly surprised that she couldn't tell them any more than Dan already had. The couple's undoubted highlight of recent times had come when they enjoyed a much-needed 2-week vacation in the Seychelles around a month earlier, reveling in the privacy of the closed resort and seizing their chance to put everything else to one side for a while. With things between them having gone as well as they had in the meantime, Dan had thought about bringing a ring with him but decided against it just before they departed. Another tourist at their resort had the same idea and proposed in front of them during a romantic dinner. And it seemed as though almost all of the other couples they encountered were there on their honeymoons. There were many moments which could have been awkward and would have been if Emma and Dan didn't share the same sense of humor, regularly joking with others that she wanted to wait until the comet was absolutely, definitely gone, and that he wanted to hold off until they could honeymoon on New Kerguelen, or at the very least on one of Timo's planned space stations. Tara looked after Rooster while they were gone, and although the old dog was now arthritic, he had the best care money could buy. He was also still as energetic and as playful as ever, even if his old joints couldn't keep up with his young heart quite as well as they once could. Another individual who had been engaged in travel of late was Billy Kendrick, whose ever-popular tours no longer visited some of the outdated locations of old, and instead now took in both Lolo National Forest and the Feather Brothers Antique Store in Salida. The Feathers store had been included ever since Michael called Emma and asked if they could go public, now that secrecy didn't matter. Seeing no harm in it, she agreed with Timo and Dan's full support. The Feathers certainly didn't need the money from the greatly increased footfall. Timo's large monthly payments would continue for a long while yet. But the brothers felt a pride in the part they had played and wanted it to be known. Additionally, everyone understood that the tourist income certainly wouldn't hurt their local area. The world at large had changed less in the last 8 months than Dan had imagined it would. With the main development being the dissolution of the GSC in its current form and William Godfrey's return to frontline party politics in London. Godfrey was currently midway through a brutally divisive challenge to Diane Logan's leadership, and Dan McCarthy was currently doing everything he could to avoid ever seeing or hearing anything about it. It took no such effort to ignore Jack Neal, who was no longer in the media's eye, having made a reluctant return to commercial PR work, while his former boss, John Cole, was equally out of the picture, having followed the tried and tested route paved by other disgraced Western leaders in opting to undertake inexplicably lucrative consultancy work for questionable governments in less liberal parts of the world. The GSC's founding charter had included procedures for dissolution, and it wouldn't take long for the national space agencies it had once consumed to return. Their buildings, staff, and funding all remained, for the most part, and strong public and political will in both Beijing and Washington ensured that levels of investment would continue to increase for years to come. One benefit of the GSC's tumultuous existence was that ground-level scientists from around the world had grown used to cooperating in their day-to-day business. This, combined with the inevitable perspective provided by the messenger's incredible landing in Birchwood, ensured that there would no longer be any major standoffs or insurmountable barriers to cooperation in mutually beneficial endeavors between Chinese and American agencies, even though the air was rife with the scent of competition. Timo Fiori, recuperating in Italy following his release from hospital and now almost walking unaided, had not given up on his big dreams for Fiori Frontieri. The organization's flagship HQ in Colorado Springs had been fully renovated under the watchful eye of Alessandro Bonucci, and it was now staffed by dozens of highly qualified scientists, all working towards goals as lofty as the Tinia telescope and the intergenerational arc. The once exciting reciprocity probe, on the other hand, was understandably no longer in Timo's plans, now that humanity had been openly visited by the very extraterrestrials with whom it had intended to communicate. Dan was happy to have met with Alessandro on several occasions, but media obligations meant that he wouldn't be joining Dan's group for their comet viewing party. A great deal of media attention had also focused on the short investigation into the Fiori Frontieri attack, during which a handful of the welcomers who were responsible for planning it brazenly came forward to state that their only regret was their lack of success. Clark's vow of vengeance found a useful outlet in his police work, which afforded him the opportunity to analyze some low-level evidence, such as communications data, between members of the demented cult-like group. 10 years earlier, Clark would likely have flown to Norway to take care of things in his own way when he successfully identified an individual who had offered anonymous technical advice to the already imprisoned man who planted the IEDs. When he actually did identify that individual, however, he passed the name up the chain of command, never mentioning anything about it to Dan or the others, and let the law do the rest. It felt good. Around a minute after Dan alerted her to the time, Emma hurriedly emerged from her bedroom.
"You didn't say we were getting dressed up?"
Tara moaned when she saw the decidedly form-fitting blue and black contoured dress Emma had chosen. Dan recognized it in an instant as the dress she had worn, out of necessity, during his appearance on Marco Magnifico's TV show just days after he got the ball rolling with the IDA leak.
"Well, what do you think?"
Emma asked him. Dan grinned. "Magnifico." He himself was more smartly dressed than normal, thinking the occasion deserved it. Tara, meanwhile, wore a casual white blouse with her own brand's name on the label. Despite likely costing as much as Emma's dress, it certainly didn't have the same pizzazz. The plan for the comet viewing party was for the three of them to drive to meet Henry, Phil Norris, and Mr. Bird at the nearby house Phil had recently bought at auction. Clark was making his own way straight from an extra shift at the precinct, where he had really settled into a nice groove, and Dan expected that he would beat them there. Dan's telescope would not be going with them. It had proven very popular with everyone in recent months as Comet Conte Abate drew near, but the comet now appeared so bright and so large that nothing could beat a naked-eye perspective. Phil's ownership of the drive-in lot where the world had seen alien beings converse with Dan had allowed him to monetize new Care Grillin' Bar and Grill and the surrounding units like never before, with interest in the location utterly dwarfing that which had been seen during its initial heyday when a media frenzy over the IDA leak had first delivered images of the lot into homes around the world. Phil's purchase of his new home had been small beans compared to the kind of cash he had made of late, but its just-out-of-town location was right up his alley, thanks to the privacy and convenience it was able to simultaneously provide. While not quite to the level Dan had indirectly helped him, Phil had aided Dan in one regard by paying for and overseeing the removal of the signal shielding material within the walls of Dan's basement. There was nothing left to keep secret, and Dan agreed with Emma and Clark's view that this was an important and symbolic thing to do, to draw a line under what had been a difficult time in their lives, when fear and paranoia had been all too prevalent. Dan had been staying at Emma's anyway, so the work caused little disruption to his life. "I'm way underdressed," Tara said, pulling at her blouse as she looked at Emma and Dan. "Tara," Dan replied, "you could literally wear a potato sack and look well-dressed next to Phil and my dad, and we're just going to watch the comet pass by. No one else will even see us. There's definitely no time for you to go home to get changed anyway." Tara ran into Emma's bedroom to rake through her clothes and grab the first acceptable outfit she could find at short notice.
"We will leave without you," Emma warned her.
"Come on, boy," Dan then called to Rooster, clapping his hands and trying to tempt the dog to follow him and Emma to the door. "We're going to visit your old home." Rooster tipped his head. He knew that word.
"That's right," Emma told him. "Home."